Hey, folks, welcome to the show. A very special guest on this week, someone that I met briefly a while ago, but been a big fan of for a long time. He was a cast member on SNL for 8 years. You know him from the star of the film The Night at the Roxbury. You've seen him on How I Met Your Mother and In the Middle. And he has a new memoir out called Baby Don't Hurt Me, Stories and Scars from Saturday Night Live. It's Chris Kattan. Great to have you on the show, Chris.
Thank you. Thanks, man. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. I really like this book because I'm a kind of a process geek, and even though I work in this industry with you, I never worked on SNL, and I know that it can be a pretty intense place to work. And just for people who don't know really how that week plays out, just to start with, just briefly explain like the process of how a show gets on the air at SNL, you know, from Monday to Saturday.
Well, let's see. Monday, you would you get a call time to come in, usually in the mid afternoon, and you go to go 30 Rock, which is where we are on the 17th floor, and we go into Lorne Michaels' office, and that's where you meet the guest host, and we all gather in there, the cast, the crew, and the writers, and we pitch our ideas for sketches to the guest host and to Lorne. And then Tuesday, all the cast and writers come into work, usually in the afternoon too, because, for some reason, we're not urged exactly, but for some reason we just write more at night, you know,
mm-hmm.
There's something about ideas and I don't know if it's the dopamine in your brain or what, but there's something about, when you stay up later, you have less time to think, you know, or overthink things. So you just do it, you know, just like the Nike slang, just do it.
Yeah.
Something about you just do it and you just write it and you just write that idea. It comes out so much more pure and from your heart and from your creative mind, you know, it works in your favor. And so Tuesday night, we do all the writing of the sketches we pitched. And you're usually allowed one sketch for yourself and one sketch with another person, but writers can cast you in as many sketches as possible. And then Wednesday we have the read through where we all read all the sketches, and they usually like maybe when back in my day it was like 50 sketches that were submitted, and also our cast was pretty great. It was Will, it was Tina, Jimmy, Seth, Molly, Maya, you know, Tracy, Fred, Daryl. It was a really great cast, and Horatio, and we read all the sketches, and there were so many good ones, you know. And then they would choose like maybe 12 of those, maybe I would say, out of the 50. So that's the first time you find out like your sketch didn't make it in, and they always say like, you know, sketches that get big laughs and some little laughs. A lot of my sketches didn't get a lot of big laughs usually. And I had to perform them a lot of the time and get out of my seat because they're usually very physical, like Mr. Peepers or Mango or the Roxbury guys, you know. So it didn't really look so good on paper as it did when you had to get on your feet to actually do the character. So that kind of came off a little obnoxious, I think, when I did it. But still worked, and Lorne Michaels really trusted it, and so I was lucky that way. So I didn't have to rely on the laughs so much as Lorne trusting my work. Mm-hmm. And then Thursday and Friday, we blocked those sketches, you know. And what's amazing is the amount of work that the set department has, you know, and the producers is like, it's phenomenal. So they have to build all these sketches, like, you know, if you just write a bit, like we're on a boat. I mean, they have to build that boat.
Right.
Like, it's incredible, you know?
Right.
It's like, you know, and I was so like, I didn't realize I was so green, you know, like I was like, okay, now we're like a Roxbury sketch. We have like three or four different sets. Like now we're there at a wedding. Now they're at the high school. Now they're here. Anyone can think, take into account, they have to build these things, man.
You know, it's funny you say that, because I saw an interview with the head set designer or builder about 2 weeks ago, and we were talking about, I guess it's in Queens or Brooklyn, where they do all the work, and they're like, they say you have to be ready for changes. And the interviewer said, what do you mean? He goes, well, they'll write a sketch that says it's they're sitting in a 1986 Buick Skylark. And then 2 hours later, it's no, it's got to be a Ford Fiesta. And they're like, what difference does it make? And the guy is like, it makes a difference. Just make it a Ford Fiesta.
Yeah, make it a Ford Fiesta.
Right. Yeah.
Well, in that case, maybe the sketch is called Ford Fiesta. Who knows?
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. So were you.
But yeah, I don't think I was ever that. I was never that specific about things. I would say weddings or high school or boats. You know, I wasn't like, it has to be a specific high school in Washington, D.C.
Right. Then it made out of brick. So now at this point, you're sort of rolling toward your Thursday or Friday at this point in the week?
Yeah. So like Thursday or Friday, you're still building the sets, and you're also blocking the sketches for camera in the studio, Studio 8H, because obviously it's going to be on camera Saturday night. So you have to rehearse. And each sketch gets like 45 minutes to rehearse each sketch. And you come in around noon on Thursday. Also Thursday, the band, the guest band, comes in and they do a sound check, which is really, always very cool. Mm-hmm. And, you know, back when I was on, we had amazing musical guests from U2 to Springsteen to The Cure to David Bowie, Prince, you know.
Yeah.
It was pretty phenomenal, the musical guests, you know. And they just to see them like rehearse and,
I know.
That was one of the coolest things ever to witness in my life. I mean, it was phenomenal.
Yeah, I know that I used to work on The Daily Show and then The Colbert Report, work on The Late Show with Colbert now. And at The Colbert Report, Paul McCartney was the guest. And I was like, I couldn't stay in that studio long enough, man. It was incredible. Like just seeing him work, like even in a sound check, you know, just was like, I know that feeling. It's just, you really feel like you're on the inside of something, you know, it's really cool.
Yeah. It's like, this is it. Like, you just have no idea. I mean, like to grasp that, like as a child and, you know, you have posters of these people in your room as a child and then you get to see them in person. It's just, it's mind boggling, you know?
Right.
I mean, although sometimes, you know, I wish, you know, for musical guests, sometimes you wish you didn't meet them because they're such an icon. And then you talk to them, it's a little different. Like when I met Bono of U2, he thought I was Jimmy Fallon. And,
sorry, I don't mean to laugh at you. That's hilarious.
This was before Jimmy got the Tonight Show or the Late Show. And this is when he did he had the Late Show. And he called Jimmy the next day and invited Jimmy, thinking it was me, to a birthday party.
That's awesome.
I was like so bummed out. Like, what a great guy, but he got the wrong person. Why did I talk to Bono?
And so Bono's at a party with Jimmy and he's asking Jimmy to do his Mr. Peepers, right? And Jimmy's like, what are you talking about? That ain't me.
Have an apple. Try it with the apple. Jimmy, bump your head.
So when you roll into Saturday, are you kind of burned out at that point? Are you just working on adrenaline when you do the show?
You're working on adrenaline the whole week. I mean, it's really like you never really take a break from the adrenaline. At least I didn't, you know.
Yeah.
I was always so fueled and so excited about Saturday, you know. It really is. When you have the honor of getting your stuff on the show, it's just so cool to be part of the show. Because when you're not on the show, you know, and you're around that week, it's really hard, you know, and it can be hard too, you know, because on Saturday you do another dress rehearsal of the sketches and then you do it for the audience. So you do the whole show, but it's a 2 hour show and you know that there's still going to be a half hour of sketches cut. And sometimes those sketches that you performed, even if they did well, may get cut for time and you just don't know, but it's hard to not taking it personally, but you know, like in life, one of the key things in life is try not to take anything personally.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
And you try not to, but I was really fortunate, you know, Lauren really looked out for me, when it came to shows, when it came to characters, you know, and I was lucky to have a lot of characters that really became reoccurring and popular, like Mango or, you know, Mr. Peepers or the goth talk characters.
Yeah.
And that was that really helped me have longevity on the show.
Why do you think he looked out for you in particular? I mean, look, you need to take a lot of credit. Your characters are brilliant and so different too, which I thought was really a mark of your genius. What do you think it was about you that he took care of you that way, or whatever the right phrase is?
I think it was the characters. You know, I think everybody had great characters. Our cast in particular was really a kind of a character driven cast. You know, with Mary Catherine and the cheerleaders, and you know, Will and Harry Carey. I mean, you know, there's this. We all had these characters, and they all became so popular, and the audience really loved these characters. That's how I was brought up. You know, I used to watch Mike Myers, and I was just so affected by how he had these great, strong characters that he lived vicariously through. You know, it was kind of like you almost didn't need to be yourself on the show, which in a way is, I always thought, a little bit more difficult. You know, like what Pete Davidson does is particularly hard to just be yourself, you know, on that show.
Yeah.
Because, you know, and being brought up from the groundlings too, I was driven to do characters, you know, and it's almost like hiding behind a mask in a way. So, the show needed that. The show needed characters, you know, and that's why I think Lauren looked out for him. It was the characters that I had that he really liked, I think.
You know, there's politics in every part of life. It's in high school, in college, in the corporate world, and certainly in entertainment. And I would imagine, and on shows that I've worked on too, I would imagine, and from what I hear, you know, there's politics at SNL in terms of getting stuff on. Is how important is it to align yourself with certain writers that tend to get more stuff on, or tend to be quote unquote the better writers that'll help you maybe get a better chance of getting stuff on? How does all of that work?
You know, I was, I had an interesting, I didn't really, when I got the show, I didn't begin at the same time everybody else did, you know, at the beginning of the season. And I wasn't even mid season. I was hired like 6 shows before the end of the season, which was an odd time. So I wasn't like, it was kind of like being in the, going into a different high school when you move and starting in, you know, sophomore year, but you only have a few more months left, you know? So I didn't really, you know, gel with anyone quite yet, except for the performers I already knew back to the Groundlings, which is Will and Sherry pretty much. And Will and I had a lot of characters already that we created at Back of the Groundlings that we were able to do again on SNL. So I didn't really have a chance to gel with the writers until later. So I always, and a lot of the characters I created on SNL were already, you know, I did them Back of the Groundlings as well. So I was very fortunate to have those already. So I kind of, you know, looked out for myself in the beginning.
Right.
So I came on that way. But, you know, in some ways, I wish, you know, there was sometimes I wish, you know, maybe I should have just like went to the writers immediately, said like, hey, let's think of this idea. Let's think of this. But I was very much like, you know, looking out for myself because I was so afraid of, you know, being canned any moment. Cause you just never know. I always had a fear of like, well, if it doesn't work out for me in this next show, I'm going to be off for something. So I always had to look out for myself. You know, I always knew that, you know, it's at the end of the day, it's up to me to take care of myself and nobody's going to take care of me. No matter how well you can work with somebody, you know, it's up to you at the end of the day.
So when you go into the show, what expectations or visions did you have and what ended up being the reality? Like, in other words, I guess what I'm asking is you have the word scars in the title of your book. What are some of the scars? And you're not the only one. You know, I know Jay Moore wrote a book about, you know, he had some tough experiences there. It's a tough place. Like you said, you never know if you're going to get canned. There's a lot of pressure. You're working on a journalist. It's a hard gig, a really, really hard gig. What came out of that for you sort of on the scar, being scarred in that sense?
Well, it really makes you grow. I mean, it's your dream job, you know, when you watch the show and everybody says like, oh my God, you guys have so much fun. And you do on Saturday, but the work ethic that you have to learn and that you have to, you know, rely on yourself, it's a lot of work, you know. It's great training, though, you know, to look out for yourself and learn how to work with others. But, you know, you always have a bit of that pressure, I think. You know, but the scars, you know, I also, like, I did get injured on the show and, you know, I had to, you know, work with that too. And that was hard to deal with while on the show.
You broke you. If turns out it turns out you found you found out from Dancing with the Stars that you broke your neck. That was years earlier on SNL. Is that right?
Yeah, I didn't. I injured myself on the show, and I didn't know it was broken until a doctor told me later. You know, like a couple weeks after that, it wasn't like I injured myself and then lied on the floor. You know, and paramedics came. It was nothing like that at all. It was because you can like break your neck and you know you can be in a lot of pain and not know that it was, you know, broken and that you need fusion and surgery until you're diagnosed. You know, you don't know what it's called until someone calls it something. Mm-hmm. And so, but you know, SNL took care of it and they're very, very cool about it. But I didn't want to talk about it. And I didn't really tell cast members. And I didn't tell really anybody about it except for maybe a couple of family members and a producer at SNL about it. And, because I didn't want to be taken out of the A game, you know, it was a different, I didn't want to be liable. I didn't want to be a liability.
Right.
Know?
Right.
And, it was nobody's fault. It was my fault for doing the stunt in the first place. It was my responsibility. It was, you know, nobody told me to, you know, commit to the character and throw myself back in the chair like I did, you know, that was all my doing, you know, but, you know, that was an actual scar that happened.
Yeah.
But there wasn't like a lot of emotional scars. I was one of the lucky ones. I had a really great time in that show and Lauren really looked out for me, you know.
Right.
He really did. And the cast was really, it was a really loving cast, you know. It wasn't like, there's so many stories about the cast, you know, back in the day with Belushi and all these big parties and crazy. And I don't think we were that big of a party cast, you know. Yeah.
And you also heard about there was tension between Belushi and Jane Curtin for whatever reason, you know, and all of that stuff, that weird stuff. Apparently he later came to respect her like for being really good. But like, you know, she wasn't a super flamboyant performer like he was in a lot of ways. And maybe he didn't respect her but in stuff that I've read and people I've talked to, like there was this sort of whatever, but apparently over the years he came to really respect her. But how did you come up for a couple of things about Mr. Peepers? I don't know how you do it physically. Like I just rewatched the sketch before we get on this interview and you're squatting on the table for like 4 minutes and throwing stuff. And I'm like, this dude is in shape. And secondly, how did you come up? And I'm sorry if you've been asked this a million times. I try not to ask obvious questions, but how the hell did you come up with that character?
I came up with that character when I was in the Groundlings. You know, I talked about the Groundlings, right? Can I remember what it was? Yeah,
mm-hmm,
I did.
Mm-hmm.
During a class, the teacher at the Groundlings said, let's do a really bad improv, like make the worst choice you can. And I was, you know, behind the door of the stage, and there was this guy, Roy Jenkins, cast member, and he was like 6'5" on stage doing some space work. And the director's like, "Catan, enter!" And I didn't know what to do, and I made the worst decision possible, and I just jumped on him. I jumped on Roy, and then, you know, being as whatever strength I had, you know, I hung upside down of him with my legs wrapped around his neck for no reason. And we're like, what the hell was that about? Why would you do that? That is the worst improv possible. But then we're like, you know what? That was really interesting too, you know? And sometimes the best ideas come out of the worst decisions. And we realized that what I was doing was very much like, you know, the monkey characters or the animals that come on The Tonight Show when, you know, Jack Hanna would bring on for Johnny Carson or Jay Leno would bring on an animal and say, this is a little Peepers. And he's, you know, he's like 4 years old. And then the little monkey would, you know, jump around and then eventually pee on Johnny Carson. You
right,
know,
is that
like
exactly.
Exactly what the kind of thing is. Whatever this is, we didn't know what to label it. We're like, is it a monkey? Is it a mongoose? What the hell is this?
Yeah. And it's also like, it's like, you can't take your eyes off the character just from a physical standpoint. Like it's a little uncomfortable it's a weird, like you want to look at it, but you don't want to look at it. And then I'm just looking at you and you are in a squatting position. It's like a catcher, like a baseball catcher for like, cause I timed the sketch out. I was looking at the timer. And it's like a 4 minute sketch. It's when, you know, Will brings you into a classroom lab, and you jump on the table and you start throwing beakers and you do the whole thing with the apple. It's just the execution and the idea of it is just really great. Did you feel like you mentioned Lauren? Just a real quick question. What is his magic? Like, obviously you see it, you see the product of his genius, if you will, but like in the moment, again, this is more of a process question. Like, what is it that he's so special at that allows him to have this longevity and be able to pick out great talent like you and then support a talent like you? What is that? What's that DNA that he has?
Well, there's a number of things that he does that is so brilliant, you know, and you don't see it until you have years on SNL. But obviously he has the gift for spotting talent. That's one thing. Mm-hmm. And I don't know how he does it too, but he really trusts talented people and their process and the growth, and he believes in them. Even before you have belief in yourself sometimes. Like, I believe in myself and my characters, but I didn't believe in its longevity, and I didn't believe, you know, how it might work on the show. And he believed in me more than anybody else on that show. You know, when I did this gibberish guy, this character called Sewell Forrester that spoke gibberish, that was a substitute teacher. He's like, "Good afternoon, I'm Somana. I'm going to be your substitute." He's like, "Today." And like, nobody in the read through was laughing. They're like, "What the hell?" Like, and Lauren was smirking, and he was like, you know, even John Goodman was the host, and they're like, "I don't know about that character." And Lauren was like, "Trust him, he'll be good." And it worked. It worked great.
Wow.
You know, and he has also, I don't know how he does it too, that's so brilliant, is that he every cast member is kind of not only, he makes them, he situates them in a place where they not only just work well with each other, but they become their own person, and they are, you know, they're like, there is that person on the show, and there's that kind of girl on the show, and like, he creates a perfect balance, you know.
Yeah,
and I think that's really, yeah, really amazing. I don't know how he does it for this long. It's really, really brilliant.
Yeah, that's the thing. That's the thing. The longevity. Listen, before we wrap up, one quick question. Did I read this right? You lived on a secluded mountain with Zen monks with Leonard Cohen and Alan Watts. You had kind of an interesting childhood. Did I get that right?
Yeah, it wasn't exactly like I lived with Alan Watts and Leonard Cohen, but I did live in a secluded area in Mount Baldy, and there was a particular area where I lived in a canyon called Barrett Canyon, and not far away was the Zen Center, Mount Baldy Zen Center, where my stepdad and mom would go to study Zen, and it was not, you know, we lived off a fire road, which isn't really a road, you know, it's like we didn't have streets. We didn't have, you know, it wasn't, we didn't really live in a neighborhood, you know, it was in a cabin. So it was a very secluded childhood. And my stepdad, you know, and Leonard Cohen they were both also Zen monks that studied with the same, teacher, Roshi is what they call them. And Alan Watts would come and speak sometime up there. So, you know, but for me, you know, a 7-year-old had no idea or conception of what Zen was, you know, what Leonard Cohen or Alan Watts had to offer and their brilliance. You know, a 7-year-old is just like, just give me my little C-3PO toy and a leash and I'll be fine. So I didn't know how much they had to offer at that age until later. You know, I wish I knew I was around this brilliance.
That's exactly right. How do you think, as we wrap here, how do you think living that secluded childhood informed you as an adult? And do you think that had anything to do with you becoming a performer or in any connection there at all?
Yeah, it made me, I think it helped me be grounded. You know, I think a lot of people, you know, and for me too, I was always afraid of silence, you know. I always had to have the TV on or the radio on, or I had to be doing something. But, you know, back then, it was okay to not do anything. It's okay to always be in moments where you don't have to be doing something. You don't have to be entertained, you know. Mm-hmm. And there's a lot of moments in life where that happens. Mm-hmm. And some people can't handle it. You know, I used to not be able to handle it either. Like, I gotta have stimulation, you know.
Yeah.
And not having that stimulation as a child, you know, that's an important place. It's an important feeling to have, you know, because it's going to happen a lot in your life, you know. And some people call it being lonely, but it's not, you know. Not if you're okay with it, you know. It's just time being alone so you could manifest and think about what's going on in life. And it's an important thing for you, I think, you know. Absolutely. It's an important part of life to get used to.
Well, everyone go out and get this book, Baby Don't Hurt Me, Stories and Scars from Saturday Night Live. It's really great to talk to you. There's so much more I'm sure we could talk about, but really great work, and keep doing the work you're doing, and really great to have you on and meet you again.
Oh, thanks, buddy. You can also get on Audible too, you know, because okay. A lot of people are like,
yeah,
can't Audible. Leave Drive, obviously, right. So.
Yeah, Amazon, all those places. Baby, Don't Hurt Me, Stories and Scars from Saturday Night Live, and take care of your neck, all right? Don't hurt yourself again.
Thanks, my friend. It's all good. Right.